Moss v. Asher. Mr. Rose.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good please the court, counsel. This is a Social Security case. For purposes of oral argument this morning, I'm only going to concentrate on maybe one or two issues. I've addressed more issues in my brief, as the court certainly is aware. What I would like to call the court's attention to was the fact that there are two primary reasons why the administrative law judge, to whom I will refer to her as the ALJ, erred at step three in the sequential evaluation process. And the first, and I think the most important issue here, is that the ALJ appears to have understood that there was a necessity to document in the medical record a quote-unquote need for the use of a cane. The ALJ was aware that, that the claimant used a cane, but there was no so-called need or prescription by a medical health care provider for that purpose. And going on from that point, she said that the claimant could not satisfy the requirements of step three under listing number 1.03, or as I argued, also 1.02, because she could not establish that she satisfied the definition in section 1.00B2B, for limitation of ineffective ambulation. That is, she couldn't establish that because she did not have the use of, she did not require the use of two canes or two crutches, which, and at that point, the ALJ seems to drop the argument and has then determined that she, that the claimant could not meet the listing because even though she had major surgery and reconstructive surgery and so forth, major dysfunction of her ankle, she still was able to ambulate effectively. However, the ALJ did not go into the second part of the definition, which must be considered in 1.00, which would be B2B2. She only went as far as B2B1. And I realize that there is a little bit of an ambiguity here because the commissioner's regulations themselves in the definition part, 1B2B1, says specifically definition. But you can't get a full comprehension of what ineffective ambulation means unless you go on to read section 1B2B2, which says to ambulate effectively. This is just the inverse of what was said in paragraph number one. But the subparagraph two goes on to say, quote, therefore, examples of ineffective ambulation include, and then there are about five different examples, but are not limited to these five examples. So that really, if there is going to be a fair evaluation of whether a person meets or equals a listed impairment, especially numbers 1.02 or 1.03, you have to take into consideration both of these paragraphs in paragraph 1.00, which is the commissioner's way of defining the various elements that go into a consideration of how a listing must be evaluated in that particular connection. Since the ALJ did not do that, I believe that this is not simply harmless error, because the ALJ did not do what was required, that is, a full analysis of whether some kind of effective ambulation could have been achieved by this this claimant. And as I called the attention to the court by reference to a Well, to two cases, actually, that have dealt with this particular section 1.00 of the listings. The first one was Coleman versus Astru, which was one of the unpublished cases by this court itself. The Coleman court, as I pointed out did in my reply brief, did not go into the whole question of 1.B2B2. It didn't go into a broadening of the analysis of in that particular case, and probably it didn't need to. However, there's another case called Dobson, which is a Ninth Circuit case, where the Ninth Circuit looked back into the commissioner's comments when the new musculoskeletal system was being set forth in the Federal Register and came up with several quotations, the most important one of which was that it, paraphrasing, not trying to quote, was that it is certainly not necessary for a person to be limited to two canes or two crutches to be considered to be unable to ambulate effectively. That is, they may not use a cane or a crutch at all and still be unable to ambulate effectively. And as a consequence, the ALJ then did not go on to determine whether or not there was any ability of the person, of Ms. Moss, to ambulate effectively. And then the second aspect of her Step 3, the ALJ Step 3 determination, was that she failed to give any kind of analysis to whether there was any equivalence. That is, in Section 404.1526, there is the requirement of establishing an equivalence if the person does not meet all of the criteria of a listed impairment. 404.1526 indicates the kind of analysis that should go into an equivalence analysis. And, of course, the fact that the treating physician had wanted to prescribe a brace for Ms. Moss to use, and she wasn't able to afford it, had no insurance. The doctor himself gave her a brace, so that perhaps the use of a brace would have had some relevance to an equivalence evaluation. It was up to the ALJ to make those evaluations in accordance with 404.1527. It was her responsibility to do this. She did not do it, and as a consequence, I believe that her unfavorable decision should be reversed, and a remand should be effectuated.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rose.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kristof.
Once again, Your Honors, Edward Kristof on behalf of the Commissioner of Social Security. I will address Step 3 of the five-step sequential evaluation because that's where the opponent is focused. Obviously, our briefs covered all of the arguments. The ALJ considered Ms. Moss's impairments under the appropriate listings in the Commissioner's regulations, and the ALJ stated that she considered them in detail. And a review of the ALJ's decision certainly bears that out. This is a solid decision. In this case, the ALJ spent a good amount of time and solid analysis considering whether Ms. Moss met or equaled the listings. The ALJ did not, as the appellant suggests, simply stop at the question of whether or not this lady needed two crutches, two canes, or a walker, thereby requiring use of both hands and depriving her of the ability to use her hands to do work, which would make it very hard to do any kind of job. Instead, that determination from the ALJ comes only about halfway through the ALJ's analysis at Step 3. Beyond that determination, the ALJ proceeds to consider the medical evidence and the evidence of what this lady's ability to function in her daily life was. He considers her testimony, he considers the written reports, he considers the reports of physicians, he considers the reports from physical therapists. And so the ALJ did not do what the Ninth Circuit criticized in the Dobson case. It didn't just say, two crutches, two canes, a walker, or you're out. Instead, the ALJ proceeded to do what this court held out to be the standard in Coleman, saying you have to go beyond that and consider the totality of the evidence. That's what the ALJ did here.
I am a little unclear on the ALJ's reasons for rejecting the opinions of Dr. Kodros, one of Ms. Moss's, as I understand it, treating physicians. And the reason for that was had something to do with having been referred to that physician by her attorney. Can you provide the background of that?
Well, Your Honor.
Because it wasn't really explained beyond that.
Dr. Kodros really didn't issue an opinion in this case in any way inconsistent with the ALJ's decision. Dr. Kodros made some findings and speculated as to what might be causing some of the problems that Ms. Moss complained of. But Dr. Kodros didn't say this woman has an extreme limitation in her ability to walk. Dr. Kodros simply noted that she had these complaints, and he ordered a CT scan, which produced nothing indicative of a disabling impairment. Indeed, it showed that she had a healing union of the bones in her injured ankle. And so the fact that Dr. Kodros was diligently following up on her complaints doesn't constitute an opinion on his part inconsistent with the ALJ's decision.
So the argument is basically that to the extent that there was error in rejecting his opinions or dismissing them because of the attorney referral, that was harmless? Is that essentially
the
argument?
My response, Your Honor, would be that the ALJ didn't dismiss Dr. Kodros' opinion. He noted that that was the factor, and it was appropriate to note that because we did have a gap in treatment here. She saw Dr. Kodros and then went a significant period of time without seeing him and then went back again. And so that's the basis for the ALJ's commentary on this. This wasn't an ongoing treatment relationship. She saw him twice for treatment and then later on a referral from the attorney. I believe that's what the ALJ was referring to here. And with regard to the equivalence argument at step three, certainly an ALJ is required to consider whether a claimant's impairments not only meet but also medically equal a listed impairment. And the ALJ expressly stated that she had considered that. She considered the claimant's impairments in combination. And we have the opinions of two reviewing physicians for the state agency that cooperates with the Social Security Administration saying that they found that her impairments did not medically equal one of the listings. And so that was expressly addressed in the ALJ's decision, and that is adequate to meet this court's minimal articulation requirements at step three. Although the claimant didn't address the residual functional capacity finding, I think it's instructive to consider what the evidence is here in this record, because step three, the step three determination, listing 1.03, requires an extreme limitation in the inability to walk. And here we have a claimant who was able to walk 600 feet with the use of a single cane. She was able to walk upstairs using a reciprocal gait. She was able to take care of herself when her husband was away on business 4 days a week. She was able to visit with family. And up until about a year before the ALJ's decision in the case, she was able to operate a motor vehicle without any significant limitation. This is not a case where we have a claimant with an extreme inability to walk that would warrant a basically presumptive finding of disability under the listings. Instead, we have a woman who has significant limitations. She sustained a significant injury to her ankle, and the ALJ's RFC finding reflects that. He restricts her to jobs that only require very minimal standing and walking, and that was the appropriate outcome in this case. If there are no questions, we would ask that the court would affirm the ALJ's decision.
Thank you, Mr. Kristoff. Mr. Rose?
Thank you. Dr. Kodros was the treating physician for Ms. Moss, or one of the treating physicians. With regard to counsel, I forgot his name all of a sudden. I'm sorry. Excuse me. Mr. Kristoff's remarks about the RFC. I think we pointed out in our brief that there was, although the ALJ does go into a considerable amount of detail, she doesn't do so with the requisite articulation of the medical evidence per se. For example, she says at one point, and this would affect her RFC, she is able that the claimant was able to walk full weight bearing, ignoring the claimant's own testimony at the hearing, that she can live independently. But what does that mean? Does that mean the rulings themselves indicate 1.00, the number 2 indicates that a person's ability to walk independently around their own home is not, without the use of an assistive device, does not constitute effective, necessarily constitutes effective ambulation. That the claimant can care for herself. These are minimal kinds of activities of daily living, and there's a good deal of precedent that these don't necessarily rise to the level of the ability to undertake sustained, substantial, gainful activity, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. Also, the ALJ does not go into a very thorough analysis of some of the medical evidence. Just as an example, at the record at page 313, where there is residual chronic pain and a lower range of motion in the ankle. This is not addressed anywhere in the ALJ's RFC determination. Or the fact that the doctor increased her Neurontin from 300 milligrams to 600 milligrams. There's got to be some reason for that. The ALJ simply states, I think at page 18 of her decision, that most of this medical evidence was unremarkable. I'm sorry, I realize I'm going over.
You may make your concluding remark, Mr. Rosen.
Okay, well, that's thank you very much. I appreciate your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Rosen. Thank you again, Mr. Kristof. The case is taken under advisement.